Plot twists. We are obsessed with them. In film, life, and love, they turn up everywhere. It's that moment in a story that takes you in an unexpected direction. I'm Tom, super fan of cinema, sport, comedy, and I'm partial to the odd impression. And throughout this series, brought to you by Now and Sky, I'll be interviewing TV and film stars, asking them all about the plot twist moments that define their lives and careers. So expect the unexpected, and hopefully some behind-the-scenes gems you've never heard before. Expect spoilers.
Oh, I love comedy. I really do. And I love a comedy duo on this podcast. And we've had quite a few over the years. Steve Coogan, Rob Brydon, Mel and Sue. Gosh, those were in the early days. And then more recently, Sam Campbell and Kevin Cagey, Gary. I remember at the time, it's a special episode because going into that, I was in a bit of a lull. Wasn't really quite feeling myself. You know, we all have those moments. But I tell you what, that full episode is on YouTube and you can see throughout, I'm in absolute stitches. It was so good. Laughter is good for the soul, I'm telling you. And we're continuing that approach this week with Josh Widdicombe and Neesh Kumar. Very excited for this. These guys don't need too much of an introduction, but I'll do a little overview. Josh Widdicombe, The Last Leg on Channel 4. It's a treasure. And a pretty big podcast with Rob Beckett called Parenting Hell. Yeah, I think you might have heard of that one. And Neesh Kumar, known for a more political stance on the comedy circuit. The MASH Report on the BBC, that was big. And then recently a podcast of his own, Pod Save the UK. And they have joined forces for series 2 of their show, Hold the Front Page. It's a show which celebrates local journalism. Josh and Neesh go to local independent publications to support their content. And the aim is to make the front page. And maybe they do, maybe they don't. I'm not going to give too much away. But they'll be in Benidorm, in Bradford, in Devon. It's fun. It's lighthearted. If you haven't watched it, do go and check it out. And if you want to go back to series 1 and see Neesh get very animated by seeing Boris Johnson, I'd thoroughly recommend that too. Anyway, let's not hold back the laughter anymore. Let's dive straight in. Josh Widdicombe and Neesh Kumar on Plot Twist. It's a pleasure, gents.
Thank you for having us.
I feel like
the pleasure's all ours.
I'm with podcast royalty here.
Big time, mate.
You're certainly with podcast. The king of the podcast.
Neesh, don't knock yourself.
Don't knock yourself. The king of the podcast is, of course, Ed Gamble. The man who has 48
That's
podcasts.
True. Ed Gamble is the king of the podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'd be on the podium, though.
I don't think I would, but I'd take that, obviously. I'd say the podium is Ed Gamble and then Chris and Rosie Ramsey together.
This is Neesh, but I put you down as the Kevin Hodges of podcasting.
Oh, the Plymouth Argyle legend.
Yeah, I thought that was...
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm looking
legacy,
for.
Legacy, bit tricky winger.
Yeah, I'd say that's fair. I often think, what if I just had like 5 podcasts and I never left the house? That'd be a nice life, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it be exhausting, though?
Yeah, it would. It sounds like you're complaining, but doing podcasts is quite tiring.
Especially with video now. Got so much
I
to
know,
consider.
You have to look like you're interested these days as well as sound like it. You?
What do you mean?
Do you find it tiring?
Well, my podcast is about the news, so it is quite depressing. It's not depressing. I don't know if you've read the news of late, Josh.
No.
Not a huge amount of it.
What's going on?
Wow, what a damning indictment on the most recent series of The Last Leg.
We covered a funny plasticine Paul McCartney. We covered the big news.
Now, we've got a lot to cover. We're going to talk about Plot Twist, on the front page, series 2, a lot to cover there. Before we do, a few randoms I thought I'd throw at you.
Yeah, go on.
And also, I said to you before, this is lighthearted, so we can do silly, we can do serious.
Great.
And Neesh, I was thinking, if you want to open up about stuff that's tricky, feel free. You know, Nina Simone, I know you regret not going to that
that's
concert.
Very true. That's very true.
If you want to talk about that, we can run through that.
I did an AS level instead of going to watch Nina Simone. Or I prepared for an AS level, shall I say, instead of going to watch Nina Simone at the Royal Albert Hall. Oh, and now I can't even remember what AS level subject I did.
And she's dead.
Furious.
She's dead. As a result of it, we'll never know.
I'm still livid about it. I'm still mad.
Yeah. AS levels. That just shows you how much younger you are than me. I don't even know what an AS level is.
Well, I think
it's a year before
I'm only like 2 years younger than you. And I think it's literally, it's the exact, it was the sort of 4-year period that AS levels existed for. I don't think they Well, maybe they do still exist. But
I think they do. It's part one of like the second.
It's just an exam that you do at the end of the first year.
What kind of sad 17-year-old's going to watch Nina Simone though? Come on, mate.
The same sad 17-year-old who earlier that year had been to see Bob Dylan at the London Arena.
What's the message to kids then?
Message to the kids is disregard your studies.
Go and see George Benson.
Go and see, yeah, if you get the opportunity to see someone in concert, they might be dead. So do it.
One day they will be, for sure.
One day, that's the only guarantee in life, is death.
Yeah.
So factor that into your exam preparation.
Yeah. There's music on every night. You're missing someone who's going to die every night.
You've got to get in there.
Yeah. Start with the oldest people. That's the way you do it, isn't it? You have to see the most likely.
You've got to see.
I've seen tickets on who's the most likely to pop it.
I saw the Stones before Charlie Watts and Bobby Keys died, actually.
Yeah. Not Brian Jones, though.
No, not Brian Jones. Well, he was actually out of the band before he passed away.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Who would you want to go and see, though, if you could see anyone? That was my first random.
Out of in history,
any performance of any kind,
Jimi Hendrix at the Monterey Festival of Pop. In fact, just the Monterey Festival of Pop, because then you'd have been able to see Hendrix, Otis Redding, Janis Joplin, and Ravi Shankar all in a weekend. Wow. Otis Redding set at the Monterey, because obviously everyone knows the Hendrix set, it's iconic, it's what launched him in America, sets fire to his guitar at the end of Wild Thing. Otis Redding set is extraordinary.
Nina Simone, Royal Albert Hall, 2002. Is that the right year? Yeah. Iconic. Yeah.
Not one to be missed.
No, she said it was her best ever gig. I'm done. I might as well die now, she said, in a few years' time.
Now, I don't want to agitate, but there's a few things here. So, Josh, you were voted the second worst dressed man by GQ magazine.
Who was number one that year?
Or Hollywood, fair enough. Awful dresser.
But I thought, Nish, what was your thoughts on that? Because I think you look smart.
Well, I'll tell you what. It was on various WhatsApp and text groups that I'm part of. It was one of our best days. It was one of our best days.
I'm not even on.
My family WhatsApp was blowing up. It was for our generation of British comedians. It was a fantastic day. Josh being voted the second worst dressed band.
No, voted is a. They just chose them. It was just one. I'd say, you know,
it was in the office.
It was a Russian election.
Yeah, it was just some work experience at GQ. It got axe to grind.
I do think you dress better now, though.
Yeah, I think I do.
Did it have an impact?
No, it's just I've grown up.
It felt slightly unfair.
It did, because I wasn't famous enough to make the list. It was quite early on.
What year was it?
16, 15, something like that.
Right, yeah.
A bit harsh.
Yeah, another bad thing that happened in 2016.
Prince's death, Bowie's death, Josh's number two worst dressed man in the country. Yeah.
And this, are you still known as Madam Lily? Is that still a thing?
Oh, God, yeah.
What's that?
One of those idiots has just phoned me this morning to abuse me.
What's this?
My cousins in Australia, when she was, the older one was like 5 years old, she started calling me Madam Lily.
Oh.
And I asked my uncle, because they grew up in Australia, I asked my uncle, is that a reference to an Australian TV show? And he just said, no. We don't know where that's come from. And so they still refer to me as Madam Lily. It's
I'm quite charming about that.
It's so weird.
It is weird.
They're so strange.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an odd one. Yeah. I like it.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah,
it'd be a good name for a tour.
Madam Lily.
Yeah.
It's not a bad name for a tour.
Mm.
Yeah.
Madam Lily. Yeah. Yeah, it's one of a string of names that those two call me.
Right, let's get to a plot twist.
Okay.
The first one. Josh, I'll start with you. So, unexpected moment in our lives. We've all had a plot twist in some shape or form that can change our story, our trajectory. What's your ultimate plot twist?
Career-wise?
Could be anything.
Could be anything. Well, it sounds bad to say career-wise then, isn't it? Because then it means that you're career-led. So you should say, meeting my wife. Do you know what I mean? But really...
But was it unexpected?
Well, I suppose it is, and it isn't, isn't it? I mean, I suppose, was that unexpected? I suppose, really, in terms of the weirdest things that have kind of changed my life, it would be agreeing to do late night comedy show about the Paralympics for 10 nights.
Yeah. I was going to say, if you don't say that, I'd be very surprised.
Yeah, I'd say that would be the weird, because I did that because it was like, no one's going to see it. I think it was on E4 when it was pitched to me.
Right.
I thought, don't know if that's a good idea, comedy about the Paralympics. That sounds like my career's going to end before it even starts. Yeah. But no one will watch it. I'll get paid. I'll get to go to the Paralympics for 10 days. And then it's kind of now the last leg, the thing that will be the first thing in my obituary as things stand. Barring me committing some kind of awful crime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
OJ Simpson thought his obituary would start with football.
I know. And then he did Naked Gun. So I'd say that was a huge career twist, because that was, no one expected the last leg to be a topical show. It wasn't meant to be a topical show. No one expected it to last 12 years. No one expected it to be anything other than what it was. And so that was a bizarre thing to happen, and career twist and plot twist. And it does show that so much of stuff is down to luck, really, I'd say, which I think is an overlooked factor in people's lives. It's not down to graft all completely. A lot of it is down to agreeing to do a Paralympic comedy show and that becoming something else, I'd say.
But also just a good recipe, right? Good timing and...
There's if I was to think about the factors that led that to be what it was meant to be, turning into what it is, it's too mind-bending to think of one thing that could have changed that would have meant that it never happened. So you've got, if any of the three of us, me, Adam, or Alex, hadn't done it, it probably wouldn't have worked as the three, particularly Alex, I'd say, because he just won a talent search to be a journalist on Channel 4, and he's able to have the skills to be really funny on live TV on a Friday night, which is incredibly difficult.
Not a given thing, yeah.
Not a given thing at all. The feel-good factor of London 2012, the fact London got the 2012 Olympics and Paralympics, which they shouldn't have, in the sense of they weren't meant to. Paris was meant to get it. Mm. So that was an upset in itself. The fact Channel 4 got the... You know, it's
lots infinite. Sliding door moments.
Lot. There's thousands of sliding door moments for that show.
That's pretty
Number cool. one being, if they hadn't got me, it would have been nothing.
Yeah. And here we are 12 years later, Kevin Hodges, a podcast.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that would be the most cool sliding doors moment. Yeah.
Yeah, because he is a treasure. Nish?
For me, it was when Josh met his wife. it was a total shock. We were all like, this man will never take a wife. He will live in a cave.
It took me out of the game, so it meant you could move on. So emotionally, it allowed you to move on.
I don't really know. There's a lot of things that I think could loosely qualify as a plot twist. I think... I mean, like, when I went to university, I, like, stumbled on a comedy society at a freshers' fair. And I had always wanted to do comedy, and then suddenly there was a way for me to do it. And that, and you know, that's how I met Ed Gamble and Tom Neenan, and that's really how my comedy career started. So, I mean, that I guess that's a pretty big plot twist. The commissioning the MASH report is a pretty big plot twist.
Yeah, because that came out of nowhere, really, didn't it?
It really did. It was like there were three pilots that were supposed to go. They put out this call saying the BBC wants to do a Saturday Night Live style show, and there was no real remit beyond that. And then every production company bid for it. We were with a production company that didn't really do comedy, and so there was no real reason. I guess there were a few things that had to happen. One, they wanted a more famous host. Everyone they asked said no. That's genuinely true.
Well, that's huge, yeah. Plot twist, isn't,
yeah,
it?
Yeah. That's genuinely true. They asked, yeah, several comedians who said no because they either already had their shows or they weren't
interested.
I had that
with Last Leg. I know two names that said no. That I won't, you know.
One of them's me, weirdly.
But yeah, you do think... But I think that a lot about things like, imagine... the six people that aren't the friends.
Yes. Yeah,
or,
yeah.
Or, like, you know.
Well, because the story that always comes up with that, which is actually kind of a famous example of it, is it happened to Lisa Kudrow because she was originally, she was the first Roz in Frasier.
Right.
And then they actually got rid of her because they thought she wasn't right. Wow. So by the time Friends comes around, she's already lived a kind of sliding doors moment of, your life's about to change. Oh, wait, it isn't.
Mm. Yeah.
And so then, yeah, you're right. I guess there were like six different other... There are lots of like what ifs that have to happen. But yeah, with the MASH, the channel wanted somebody else to host, which made sense. I also was working on a different one of the pilots that I got sacked from. So I had to get sacked from that one in order for me to be free to
do this. Were you working
in
front of the camera?
Yeah. Oh, so wow. They basically got rid of a bunch of people from that pilot that we'd been working on.
That's incredible.
So I sort of had to. That's the only reason I was free. Mm. And then I did the audition for the hosting. My agent at the time said, "You won't get the hosting job, but if you do a good enough audition, you could get a correspondent job." Because that's what we were aiming for. Then they couldn't find anyone else to host. The producer, I believe, the people who made it wanted me, but I think there was a concern that they would. Then it came to the actual pilot record, which went really well and we all had a really nice time, but we assumed it wouldn't get made because the other two shows both had much higher profile people involved in them. But the other two shows, I think, basically for whatever, they didn't really fulfill the remit that they were being asked to fulfill. So it isn't necessarily whether they were good or bad or better or worse. It was just that they weren't the right type of show that the BBC was trying to get on at the time. Then it sort of, it kind of started in with four episodes that did pretty well, but didn't really pull up any trees. But because they'd commissioned 10, we finished the run of 10 and the back six of that in January 2018. And the clips from that that went viral are probably the reason I have a career, really. Like, well, certainly they're the reason I have the career, the shape of it right now. It's
right,
because
right.
really of like that run in 2018.
There's, amazing how it plays out.
Yeah. And there's so much, you know, it's not luck, I suppose. Because I remember saying to Hilsey on Last Leg, God, it's lucky that all these things happened. And he was kind of like, and I'd say this, you say that about the MASH report, that like, if that had happened. But I suppose the thing is, it's like, to use a football analogy, I suppose, if the ball falls to you, you've got to then...
Got your chance.
Well, you've got to take your chance.
You know, it's that thing, that the outliers thing, the Malcolm Gladwell thing, where they always... The thing that everyone remembers from it is that you have to do 10,000 hours. He uses the Beatles as a case study, and he says you have to do 10,000 hours. That's actually only one of several things that has to happen. So he actually talks about, like, the cultural environment needs to be right, conditions need to be correct. But then I think it's a combination of you have to be ready, and then also that it's a combination of luck. You're right, Josh, to say, and Adam is right to say that it isn't all down to luck. Mm. But then it's a combination of things falling in the right way and you being ready for them to fall in the right way.
But also persistence, because you said in the first couple of years of your career that actually it was pretty rough, you know, trying to get through it and, you know, trying to make waves. And
yeah.
Oh my God, I've got messages that you and I exchanged. I found them, like screenshots from Facebook Messenger, which I don't even have access to. I don't even have my Facebook anymore. But I have screenshots of messages Josh and I sent each other in 2009 being like, it's going real bad, man. Yeah. Boy, this comedy's going really bad.
Yeah. I tell you another... It's just so weird where you go. But these are all like... I was talking to you about this earlier, actually, in the car, about when I was in Train Crash with James Acaster, and I was going to the Leicester Mercury New Act of the Year, or Act of the Year, whatever it was called. Beckett was actually in the final, and Ivo was in the final as well, Ivo Graham, Rob Beckett. And they, it was very tense to have to do competitions. I was never very good at them. And
not as bad as me, to be fair. Josh actually made the final of a few competitions.
And me and James had a gig in Leicester on the same day, so we went up together, and our train derailed just outside Market Harborough. Terrifying. All the windows were smashed with stones and all this.
Oh, Jesus.
And then we had to sit there for 4 hours. It was horrific.
Acaster had already written off a couple of cars by this point, so he was just like, please slash on,
No,
brother.
This was pre him almost killing himself and Josie Long.
But I think he'd done two. That's the third. Remember, that's the third car that he'd written off.
There's some plot twists.
Wow.
Anyway, long story short, we were stuck for 4 hours it looked like I wasn't going to make the gig.
Right.
And then I had to turn up at the gig and go straight on after the break. So there was none of the tension, all of that. And I had a really amazing gig. And you kind of go, and I won. And my agent, who I've had since, was there and I got signed from it.
Right, yeah.
And you go, if I'd been half an hour later, I wouldn't have got to do the gig. Or if I hadn't been in the train crash, I'd have probably been terrified. I might have gone on first, all these
right,
kind of things.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So there's plot twists there.
That's a serious plot twist.
Yeah. Do you know what? Should have gone with that one.
Right. Hold the front page. Let's talk about that. I'm going to be honest with you guys. Like, yeah. Would you say you're good journalists?
No.
No. I'd say you're the best we've ever
yeah,
asked.
Yeah, yeah, no, we're bad. No, I don't.
I like the passion. The passion's
clearly
there.
Yeah, I think we're trying our best, right?
Yeah.
I think we're trying our best.
It reminds me of our friend Tim Key. He was described in a review as being a deliberately bad poet, and he said, there's nothing deliberate about it. That's very much the way that I feel about our journalism. It's not deliberately bad. It's us trying to do it well. I think it's weirdly a thing that I think about a lot with Taskmaster, because when I got asked to do Taskmaster, it was maybe in a different era in terms of the infrastructure of that show, because the person who asked me was Alex Horn, and the way he asked me was he phoned my personal mobile number from his personal mobile. I'm pretty sure there's now a couple of layers that would be involved, but he phoned
me. It was more that in those days, your agent was very bad at the female. Your agent at the time. I on more than one occasion was asked by a producer to phone Nish to check whether his agent had got the email, because they had
true.
No response.
Wow. That's all true. All 100% true.
Do you still have the same agent?
Nope. No, I do not. Did you just
phone Nish and ask him personally if he'd do the last leg?
Yeah,
because we haven't heard back. Yes or no?
Oh, my God, the number of emails. But when Horn phoned me to talk about it, he said, the two things I would say is don't talk to anyone about the task. He was very concerned about me and Aisling B because he knows we're good friends. But then the second thing he said was, the main thing is you don't have to try and be funny. We've configured
that's
everything.
That's why we picked you.
Yeah, that's why we picked you. Otherwise, there's no way we'd have got you. Yeah. But the we actually wanted someone more famous, but they all said no. But he just kept saying, like, it's configured, so if you try to do it properly, it will be really funny. Mm. And we picked
it's like an apprentice task.
Yeah.
You can't do well on an apprentice task. They're configured, I presume. Like, you watch that show, you're like, I'm sorry, it is impossible to come up with a cleaning product and make an advert that isn't shit for it in 48 hours.
Well, you guys were in Benidorm this series, right?
Yeah.
And she wanted 10 stories in a day.
Yeah.
It was impossible.
Mental.
Yeah, but
that is what they're doing.
Well, yeah, this is the thing. The only thing that I would say is, in comparison to The Apprentice, the Apprentice is done under stunt conditions. You know, there's no business model that would require you to do that. Whereas with us, when she says we want 10 stories, journalists for them do deliver 10 stories.
Yeah.
So we aren't being asked to do things that they don't ask of proper journalists.
That's pretty incredible.
So the whole time we're trying to just do the kind of machinations of the job.
Yeah.
And then knowing that two underqualified people trying to be journalists is going to, I don't say unqualified, because Josh literally is a qualified journalist.
So you study journalism,
yeah,
right?
Well, I did a postgrad.
And he clearly slept through most of it.
Yeah, I didn't
Not
do
my
much
words.
Work. Didn't do much work.
So, it's like we're trying to go through the motions. We're trying to file articles. Sometimes we do it.
Mm.
Yeah.
But a lot of the time, it's the volume, I think, that always makes... Even at weeks where we do brilliantly and we do get the front page, and there are weeks where we do get the front page, at the end, there is always a moment where the editor says, so you're on the front page, it's amazing. I mean, you've filed about a third of what you should have filed.
Yeah. Well, she was quite scary, actually, that lady.
I liked her. She was one of those people who...
Old school.
Yeah.
Like, well, she's one of those people, you know, like in a kind of film or something where you think they're scary, but actually they've got your best kind of like...
Dr. Cox in Scrubs.
Oh, I was going to say the pigeon woman in Home Alone.
The pigeon woman in Home Alone.
Piers Morgan.
Another good one. Not Piers Morgan.
No, not Piers Morgan.
He is someone who has your worst interests at heart.
Oh, yeah.
He's the
no, but that's the theory
woman.
That he played the pigeon woman in Home Alone 2. Have you seen that? Have you seen that online?
Well, isn't it just a woman with where the makeup is done to make her face look red? Is that basically it?
You do a side-by-side comparison. I don't want to knock the lady.
He's with Trump from the second Home Alone 2.
Yeah. what particular stories did you enjoy researching and doing? Because you've been all over the place.
Do you know what I loved doing was trying to catch the Beast of Cumbria?
Yeah, but it was an ill-conceived mission on our part.
Because I like the idea that we went all in and whether have a guess whether it paid off, but I won't give it away.
Yeah.
Like, there was part of me that when I was sat in the rain, in the pissing rain, on a Cumbrian hillside in the pitch black, wondering if that light in the distance was a beast or whether it was just one of our camera crew.
And it was always one of our camera crew.
I did think, this is exciting.
Yeah.
This is I like that. I the same one we did a haunted pub.
Yeah.
Once again, no dice. I enjoyed trying to solve.
Presumably, listeners to this podcast could have guessed that based on the fact that there hasn't been a news story ghost discovered conclusively by idiots and Beast of Bodmin Moor mauls comedians.
Right, the fact that
some listeners will need clarity.
250 miles away, 350 miles away from Cumbria. Is one of the issues. I enjoyed those.
I really enjoyed... There's a story about a river cleanup in South Wales that involves a cameo from Charlotte Church, who's genuinely very, very involved in campaigns to clean up our sewage-strewn rivers and coastlines.
That feels a bit more meaningful.
It was great. It was
the
really
Beast of Cumbria?
Well, I was thinking of Gus Honeybun.
Oh, yeah. Did you watch that one?
I did watch that one. Yeah. And in Benidorm, that was great,
Yeah. Gus Honeybun was a... Yeah, that wasn't as meaningful.
But
as
that was meaningful. That was more meaningful than anything we've done.
Well, it was to you, but you described him as a diseased rabbit from the 80s.
It was truly, and I will say this: like, this is not a lie for the show. I genuinely never heard of Gus Honeyman before. When I approached it, I thought Josh had a nervous breakdown because he kept saying, "Oh no, it was this brilliant thing." There was
but that's unrelated.
yeah. Sorry, Josh had a breakdown, and he was talking about Gus Honeybun.
Yeah.
But he kept saying everyone who grew up in Devon is obsessed with Gus Honeybun, and I sort of the thing with Josh is that he has some very specific interests. Like if you listen to Josh, everyone is obsessed with the footballing career of Neil Razor Ruddock, like
it's John Beresford.
Exactly. It's like very specific 1990s things. But when we got to Devon, everyone, as soon as we mentioned Gus Honeybun, would genuinely light up. They were thrilled by it. Older people generally, but there were still some like when we actually got down to relaunching Gus's career. Yeah. There were little kids there with Gus Honeybun dolls because I think their parents had bought them.
It was like a Hard Day's Night.
Wow.
But when you look at Gus Honeybun, if you haven't grown up with Gus Honeybun, you think that's one of the most disgusting things I've ever seen. It looks like a haunted
rabbit. Quite jarring.
Yeah.
But I think there's a thing where, like, you get it with puppets. I think it's a fascinating world where the puppets of the 80s and 90s...
Yeah,
City and
we
Sweet.
Will have, like... We've all done TV shows where something like Mr. Blobby or George from Rainbow or whatever on. You can do a TV show with, you could do Graham Norton and you're on with, I don't know.
Mark Ruffalo. And Mark he calls Ruffalo, you and say he implies that you're a paedophile.
Yeah, well, that might happen. But that might happen.
Yeah.
But
that was outrageous.
That's one of my.
He was a lovely bloke. I liked him.
Him making a joke implying you're a paedophile is one of my all time. It's that.
The WhatsApp group went crazy.
You see, as my top two television moments of all time. I was touring in New Zealand, and me and Rose Matafeo specifically were like, after a gig, got a McDonald's and found the TV in the place we were staying and plugged my laptop into it so we could watch Mark Ruffalo call Josh a paedophile on the Graham Norton show.
Did he say anything afterwards?
He was a lovely bloke. We got on really well. It was taken out of context in the clip. Because it was a running joke. But you can meet Mark Ruffalo or Ian McKellen or whatever. You're not that fussed about getting a selfie with... But there's something about those kind of kitsch characters from your youth that cut through. So you have Mr. Blobby on the last leg. You'll have a queue of people getting selfies with him at the end.
Yes,
you have Brian Cox... Not people aren't as fast, even though Bronk.
Just me.
No,
trying to get him to tell me to fuck off.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, he did that on this podcast.
Oh, did he? Yeah.
Yeah, oh, it's a dream. It's scary, but also quite. Yeah.
He was in series one of Hold the Front Page.
He was in series one of Hold the Front Page. Lovely bloke.
Yeah, he was lovely.
He's lovely.
Yeah.
I've got some news headlines from like local publications. Yeah. I'm not going to lie, they're pretty Partridge, actually.
Yeah.
They're very Partridge. Yeah. Why a man shaved head to look like a badger?
Yeah.
But yeah, I'll say some of them to you, and then you can tell me what you think and whether it's true or false.
Yeah, okay, fine. Okay.
So frogs are screaming, but we just can't hear them.
Oh, wow. That's a sad. That's so sad. If you've made that up, you've got a diseased mind.
Yeah, I'm going to say true, because I think it's genuinely.
It's true. Snake found in Mrs. Tassisworth's letterbox.
No, they wouldn't use Mrs. Tassisworth.
They wouldn't use Mrs. Tassisworth. That's got to be fake.
That was fake. I did that last night.
Quite innuendo-y, that.
It was. I put letter in front just to, just to be, you know, clear. Johnny Depp buys a bath in Cockermouth.
No, not true. Oh, that might be true.
I think that might be true.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah.
I've kind of bent the truth. It was in Norwich.
It was in Norwich.
So why did he buy a bath?
I mean, ask Johnny Depp. I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah. Listen, disgraced former movie stars have got to do something with their time, I guess.
Exactly. I thought he was in financial problems, but here he is getting a bath shipped in from Norwich.
A US baseball team has been accused of fat-shaming after naming its pig mascot after a weight loss drug, Ozempic.
I feel like that's false.
I think it's false. I think it's too recent.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts?
True.
It's true.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So have they taken on a sponsorship with Ozempic? Or have they just done it?
No, they've got a pig mascot, but they just decided to call it Ozempic.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Not even a Zen pig.
That's a shame.
A waste of everyone's time.
Yeah,
can't do all the work for you.
What are the odds? Exeter man receives 5 identical birthday cards.
Oh, wow.
5 identical birthday cards.
That's such a good story if it's not true.
It's amazing, right?
Yeah, true.
Is it true?
It's true.
Wow.
Yeah.
And do we know what it was?
I've got no idea.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, that's so good. It's so funny. I don't think I even received 5 birthday cards.
Yeah. You don't anymore.
No.
That's just the way it is.
I'm trying to think. I think my partner and her family are quite prolific card buyers. So
right.
I do think I get a few.
Yeah.
But maybe not 5.
Yeah, 5 are the same as well.
5's
the same. Yeah, that is great. That was from, Exeter Express.
Great.
Yeah, so, the Express and Echo.
Yeah, there you go, yeah.
They wanted to do a news story about me.
I'm not surprised.
Local doing legend. I made reference on Mock the Week to how Exeter still had an Athena.
And?
It had closed down like 18 months before.
Out of touch millionaire comedian Josh Willoughby.
In his ivory tower.
In his ivory tower. No idea what's happening. There hasn't been an Athena here for just over a year. The guy's out of touch.
Gone his roots.
He's basically a white Rishi Sunak.
They are quite intriguing, though, these headlines.
Yeah.
Like, you know, why a man shaved head to look like a badger? I want to know more about that.
Yeah, exactly. Click through.
Well, we've got so much more, I think, such a specific sympathy because of the amount of stories each journalist is having to generate. Now when I see, like, people going, look at this crazy local news story, I was like, it was probably 3:30. And the guy was just like, okay, that man's head looks like a badger. I just picture some very, like, tired local newspaper reporter who spent the morning probably doing some, like, quite important story about some government policy that's going to have really serious implications for their local area, but is obliged to file 2 more stories and is just looking around the high street going, is anyone's head shaped like Harry Styles, just anything. Yeah.
But why did he shave it? That's the question I thought. Why not? You know, I thought you'd want to have a bit of hair there to look like a badger.
Well, badgers don't have a shaved bit, do they? They have white.
Probably
black.
Grade 4.
I would have thought if you were badgering, you're not going. Yeah, I believe it's a technical term. If you're badgering, I wouldn't think you were shaving. You're dying. You're dying black with a white streak.
Yeah.
We'll never know.
We'll never know. Well, there we go. That was those plot twist person.
Obviously
next,
my wife.
Yeah. Do you want to start there?
Who would be your plot twist person, Nish?
Unexpected source of inspiration. It could be any point in your life, career.
I mean, I guess you expect family members and your partner to be people that have profound impacts on your life.
Yeah.
Yes.
But then your career surprised them, right?
My career surprised my parents.
Yeah.
Yeah. It shouldn't have. I would argue they weren't paying enough attention, which is what I say to their faces. Because all I did was watch The Simpsons, watch Goodness Gracious Me, read The Simpsons episode guide,
and watch
Ross Noble. I was like, I don't know what about this you thought was going to add up to any other version of a career. I mean, I guess, like, I think probably, but again, I don't know how unexpected this is. I guess Ed Gamble is quite a plot twist person in my life. I met him at university. Gamble and Neenan, I met at university. But Ed had just started doing, so there was a sketch comedy group at our university, and you would write a show a term and then go to Edinburgh. And then Ed had started doing it from our first year, and then Tom and I joined in our second year. So he knew a little bit more about what, but also Ed was actually a bit more keyed into what comedy was as a job, because he really wanted to do it from when he was younger, and he'd also had a bit more of a set. He'd had more than just the impulse of, I would like to be a comedian. He'd actually tried to work out what that would entail. And yeah, and he took it very seriously. Like when it wasn't like a sort of university like lark for him. He was really like, I really want to do this professionally.
So you weren't thinking this is a career. This is more.
No,
of
I was, but I just hadn't really thought about it beyond. I would like to do with a lot of things in my life. I thought only just the very top layer of, I would like to be a comedian. I didn't want to do anything else, but I hadn't done any other research into what it would involve.
Right. Yeah.
And then Ed and Tom actually set up the stand-up night at our university, which is the first time I ever did stand-up. So I guess I would say probably Ed and Tom, maybe.
Just encouraged you a bit more, maybe.
But, and were just a bit more savvy than me in terms of not just going, I want to be a comedian, but actually going, what would that... So how do you do that? Whereas I was just like, I want to be a comedian. I was just sat there going, and I'm sure somebody will invite me on television now. I've announced my intentions. It's like when Michael Scott declares bankruptcy in the American Office episode. Yeah. Like, I declare that I want to be a comedian, and then just stood there.
Yeah.
And I guess Ed and Tom did more than just stand there and say, we would like to do this as a job.
You said that it took you 7 or 8 years to learn how to write comedy.
Well, arguably, it's an ongoing process.
That was left hanging as a sentence, wasn't it? You're saying 7.5 years. Are you 5 years in?
Yeah. It took me 5 years to not have a day job. And then it took me, I would say that from about 2015 onwards, maybe 2014, actually. I think from the Edinburgh show I did in 2014 is when I kind of was like, in retrospect, I had worked out to some extent how to do stand-up in a way that I enjoyed.
Mm.
So I would say probably it took me from, until I was 29 to really, from the age of about 21... to 29 to really work out, like, but really the best part of a decade to work out how to do it to some extent. And then you keep going. It's an ongoing process of,
Of course,
learning and evolving.
Yeah. Josh, plot twist person?
My older half-brother Henry was very much into... So they didn't live with me, my half-siblings, because we had a different mum. That was a weird pause. tired. It's been a long day.
Late into a day in promo, you will forget who your parents are.
But he was into stuff that was, having an older sibling that was into comedy and was into music as well, you absorb that stuff in a way maybe I would never have absorbed it, if that makes sense. And so you have older tastes than you should if you were just the older sibling. So I'd say that was a huge influence on me in terms of what I ended up being into, because you see your older siblings as cooler than you, as more kind of, they very much influence you, and so you want to do what they are into.
Also, I know Henry and he is cooler than you.
According to GQ. So that would have been a huge one. And then... I think that's really kind of the important one in that respect, because I think in terms of shaping who you are, which obviously is huge, I'd have gone with that. I don't think there's anyone who you go, do you know what? It's weird, but there's people you've never met or like famous people that have a big influence on you.
Mark Ruffalo.
Mark Ruffalo. Well, I have met him. Once bitten.
He made some allegations.
But I think, you know, I think it's underplayed how much influence watching people listening to their music can have on you. That can change your life far more than people who are in your immediate orbit.
Mm.
But I suppose, you know, as you say, when we discuss the Gus Honeybun thing, I'm someone that really obsessed with like popular culture, and that was really big for me growing up and stuff. So I probably was influenced far more by that than my peer groups, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, that could be loads of people, but I think it's much easier to find someone, whether that be, you know,
Frank Skinner
or Harry Hill or, you know, French and Saunders or whatever that, you know, Harry Enfield that you're into when you're growing up in terms of comedy or just in terms of your aesthetic. I mean, there's weird ones like you go, the reason I went to Manchester University was because I like the Smiths. So,
I really hope the Morrissey influence doesn't run all the way through with you. Otherwise, series three of Hold the Front Page could be very interesting.
Well, so I'll choose Johnny Marr. but like, things like that can change the course of your life in a really weird way. Do you know what I mean?
Even just like your behaviours. I love Ronnie Barker. I just like his mannerisms and his quirks. You find yourself doing those sort of things.
Do you know what totally changed my comedy career? It was supporting Stephen Merchant on tour. Because I think that made me, I think the best thing you can do, and this happened to you and Acaster, is support someone on tour. Because I think you spend the whole time as a comedian, when you become professional, in comedy clubs where it could go wrong at any point. It's quite a drunken kind of intense atmosphere. And you're really playing on your toes and you're just trying to get through the 20 minutes. And then you support someone for 3 months and I just learned to play. It's just so much more chilled. It's the theatre. They really believe in you, but they've come for a different kind of night out. And also you learn to normally play. We did 10 nights at Hammersmith Apollo. And by night six, you're like, oh, for God's sake, Hammersmith Apollo again. And you learn through just being the lucky person that gets to support this person. You just get so used to playing on a big stage.
But also what's funny about it is like the size of rooms you go from, the factor of multiplication is like, it's like 10 times bigger. Like, Acaster and I, Josh is referencing the fact that me and Acaster both supported Milton Jones at different tours that he did. And you go from like a 90-seat comedy club to a 2,000-seat theatre. So like the number of people, the factor of multiplication is bananas.
Did you ever change your material when you're going from a 90-seater where it might be a bit more rowdy, a bit more aggressive to something like a 2,000-seater where it is a bit more gentle?
The reason that it was good is it allowed me to write longer routines, because in a comedy club, you're like, get in, do the joke, get out, do the next joke, because they can't focus.
Yeah.
Wow. So you're just, I'd say, there's a book called How Music Works by David Byrne, and there's a chapter which is about how you can trace loads and loads of different musical styles. They reflect the rooms that they were played in. So choral music being an example of that, that came out of the acoustics of that room, to punk clubs needing to be loud and in your face in that small room.
Oh, it's like one of the great unspoken, well, it's not unspoken because Big Boy talks about it all the time. Like, he's part of the reason Southern hip hop sounds the way it does is in the kind of late 80s and early 90s when that sound was really evolving, the place that it would get played the most was in strip clubs. And Big Boy and Andre 3000 literally talk about how the Southern hip hop was influenced by having to make music that sounded good in a strip club. Like, it's a really weird bit of that tradition.
And I think that's really true of comedy, that you...
It has to work in a strip club.
It has to work in a strip club. And my stuff got sexy as fuck. Sexy, rhythmical joke. No, but, like, and so you end up picking up these habits that make you... So when you start out on the open mic circuit, you learn to play to seven people.
Yeah.
And there's actually, you get better at that, but those skills are not very useful the further on you get. Yeah. And then you learn to play a comedy club to drunks.
Yeah.
And those skills actually aren't very good for when you want to play theatres or when you want to go on TV. Because when you go on TV, it strips away most of the stuff that isn't material. I'd say the material is much more clear on TV. You can't kind of push it through with performance in the way you can in a comedy club. And so I think doing that support gave me all the right habits for then doing my own tours and doing television, which were getting knocked out of me by doing the comedy clubs. Mm.
But I always think one of the lessons I learned with Milton particularly is that how exacting it was about his material. He really was, and also at that point, it was very clear to me when I was having a good gig or a bad gig.
Mm.
Very clear. In a comedy club, it was very, very clear. But Milton, we were touring and he would do one night and then it would sound amazing. And then the next night it would sound amazing and he'd go, oh yeah, it wasn't very good. And you suddenly realise that his whole metric for what is a successful gig has completely shifted.
Mm.
But also he would be very exacting about, he made sure the material was... He was so precise and he worked so hard on every word. And I think that definitely was something that I took from that. Instead of just sort of, you know, even though we're completely different styles of comedian, which is why he has, his support acts are very often very different tonally to him, because he wants to have some variety to the evening's entertainment. Mm. Even that level of consideration is something that I still...
It shows an exaggeration, doesn't it? Suppose,
yeah, it, absolutely, yeah. Yeah. And so, but I remember thinking, I really need to make sure that I'm thinking about the, because he actually didn't have to be.
Mm.
He could have coasted because at that point he had become so beloved. You know, if you go and see Milton now, his audience love him so much that he could almost coast, but the fact that he chose to not to is pretty much something definitely that I think about a lot.
And you wouldn't necessarily think about that, would you? Well, it's like two comedians that appear the same, like a Jeff Ross, or I've referenced on this podcast all the time, Don Rickles.
Yeah.
Quite a put down, fast sort of style of comedy. But their methods of preparation were worlds apart.
Yeah.
Jeff Ross is like looking over his notes, every word, like you say. Don Rickles is like, oh, sod it, just go out and, you know, do my thing.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's interesting how it can be so different in prep.
And I think it's easy to get set in your ways. For this tour that I've started writing, that may be announced at some point, do sign up to the mailing
list. I was going
to
say, what's coming up next?
I might be announcing a tour that's miles away. Well, in distance and in time. But due to having less time before each gig, because I was in the middle of stuff, I was just noting down ideas for routines and then trying to do them on stage, whereas I used to sweat over them.
Mm.
And I found myself coming up with way more. And I was like, it's like, you're like, oh, there are other ways to do it. You kind of get set in your ways of doing it.
And that's less pressure then, really?
It's less pressure. You come up with stuff. You're like, oh, I've got a year. I don't need to be sweating over this word before this warm-up gig 16 months before the first show of the tour. But you find different ways of doing stuff. I think generally there's a podcast called The Comedian's Comedian Podcast with Stuart Goldsmith that's great. What you realise when you listen to that is everyone has a completely different way of doing it. There's no right way of doing it. Any comedian who tells you how to do it based on their own experiences doesn't understand that and shouldn't be trusted. And that's kind of the way it is, really. I think people talk a lot about do it this way, do it this way. This is a technique. I think 95% of stuff that you learn to do naturally by just doing it.
It's the only right way is the style of doing it that's comfortable for you. That's the only correct way.
Yeah, you've got to be authentic, haven't you?
Yeah, and also there are working methods. Some people will go on stage with four bullet points. Other people write everything out word for word. There's so many different.
There's no right or wrong way. Yeah.
Nish, have you got anything coming up you want to talk about? Other than, obviously, Hold the Front Page.
Hold the Front Page, April 24th. I have a tour that's actually happening soon. September, I start a UK and Dublin. I have been saying a UK and Ireland tour, and people in Ireland are rightly furious because I'm only going to Dublin. But I'm doing a tour all over the UK and one night at Vicar Street in Dublin.
Why not Cork?
September. I don't know why I'm not doing... We're trying to do Cork, but I think the dates couldn't work. We couldn't work the dates out.
Why do you hate Cork?
I don't know, but I do. It's yeah, that's from September onwards. So I'll be everywhere.
Nice. I've just thought of one final plot twist.
Mm.
Hold the Front Page, plot twist special. Was there an unexpected moment across series two that caught you off guard?
Yes, I'm sure there is. I think
nothing's been as big a plot twist as Johnson turning up, though.
No, that was mad. That was
series. Nothing's been as a strange a plot twist, because we did just junk a whole.
We just junked
a whole plan.
How angry were you, Nish?
As angry as I seem.
And I was as delighted as he was angry.
There's video evidence of it. Nothing in the second series was as big a plot twist, because we didn't have to. There were minor things, like we had to. Like, we'd gone to the Isle of Wight because it was Cows Week, which was a sailing week, and it just rained.
Cows Week was pulled off. And there's just footage of us trying to be interviewed about the fact we've now had to go and cover the circus. Yeah. And we're outside the circus and my umbrella blows inside out during the interview. You're like, do you know what? This is worse than Boris Johnson.
But the biggest plot twist, because truly, that came out of absolutely nowhere. The editor of the paper genuinely called us and said, he's coming tomorrow. That, and, you know, he was still prime minister. It was a whole strange thing. And that I would have been amazed if we'd managed to get something as wild a plot twist as that.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially given the backstory, I suppose.
Well, especially given the way that it played out.
Yeah. Guys, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh,
thank
it's been
you
a joy.
So much
thank
for coming
you so
on.
Much.
Thank you.
Good luck with series two. Hopefully there's series three on the way.
Fingers crossed.
Come back and talk about that again.
Cheers. Series three, for me, if anything, would be a plot twist.
You've done about five of the Match Report, haven't you?
Oh, yeah, we did five of the Match
Report. Yeah, don't put yourself down.
Yeah.
I've never... Yeah. I'd say if you hit three, you've got a mega hit on you.
You've got a mega hit. Three series on British TV is a mega hit. Three series on American TV is a disaster. They make documentaries. Three series of on British TV and you're a Hall of Famer.
Well, Hall of Fame, how many podcast episodes are you on?
No idea.
Exactly. Hall of Fame.
But crucially, they can't cancel a podcast.
We'll see, Josh. Give me time.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Big thank you to the Kevin Hodges of podcasting and Nina Simone's biggest fan, Josh Whitaker and Nish Kumar. Lovely to have them on. Fascinating chat, full of laughs, but also very insightful. I mean, this podcast is always going to have sliding door moments. It's part of the setup of a plot twist, but my goodness, there were some. I mean, Josh Whitaker talking about that big performance he gave where he meets his agent, but beforehand, a train derails, so he's probably not as nervous. He's shedded the skin of anxiety, and it's what led to one of his best performances. And you just wonder, what if the train hadn't derailed? Would his performance have suffered? I mean, it's incredible. And then Nish talking about Malcolm Gladwell, the 10,000 hours, but actually it's not just about putting in the effort, putting in the time. It's also the timing, it's the location, it's the people around you, it's the environment in those certain moments. Probably working with someone like Ed Gamble in the beginning of your career, that probably helps too. Amazing. Really enjoyed talking about their show, Hold the Front Page. I've had a preview of series two. It's a lot of fun. It comes out on the 24th of April on Sky and available on Now. Lots of funny moments. And I tell you what, it makes you respect local journalism. Do go and check that out. Big thank you to them. And next week, our guest is one of, if not the most recognized anti-hero in Hollywood, Danny Trejo. From Breaking Bad to Sons of Anarchy to Michael Mann's Heat, this man has had a life. I cannot wait to talk to him and delve into some of his stories. He's going to have a few. And he happens to be opening up a restaurant in Notting Hill as part of his chain, Trejo's Tacos. So we're going to talk about that as well as his own plot twist. It's going to be fascinating. That's next week. Looking forward to that. And until then, ciao, guys.